morning, Council. Today is Wednesday, June 21st, 2023. We have three cases on our calendar today set for oral argument. This is the second of three. This is A22-1848, White v. State of Minnesota. I believe both of you are familiar with our processes, 15 minutes for each and 5 minutes rebuttal by respondent. And as you know, you can raise and lower the podium to adjust. Counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready, you may begin. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing.
Good morning. My name is Zach Longsdorf. I represent appellant William White, Jr. The district court relied heavily on the procedural bar as a basis for denying Mr. White's joinder, ineffective assistance of trial counsel, and impartial jury claims. This ignores that Mr. White raised those claims in the context of an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim. Claims related to the effective assistance of appellate counsel are properly raised in post-conviction. By their very definition, the procedural bars apply to claims that could have been raised in an earlier proceeding. Claims of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel on direct appeal are not barred because they could not have been raised any earlier. This is the first proceeding since
the district court also decided those issues on the merits.
I think the district court did also conclude that the claims were without merit, and I'll address the merits in just a minute. But
because even if the district court was wrong as to ineffective assistance of counsel, I mean, wrong in applying NAFLA and a procedural bar. If the claims fail in the merits, they fail anyway, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And I think Mr. White's main contention is that appellate counsel was ineffective for failing to raise these certain claims, the ineffective assistance of trial counsel, the impartiality of the jury, and then in raising his joinder claim in a way that had no chance of succeeding. And what happens is when this claim is brought based on appellate counsel not raising these issues of merit or in raising them in a way that's got no chance of succeeding, showing that the underlying issues actually have merit is how Mr. White would be able to get relief in this case.
All right. Can we talk about your, it seems like four or five different issues you're really raising on the merits. And I'm trying to get my mind around the Schwartz jury misconduct allegation. As I see the argument presented as to juror misconduct, there has to be some specific misconduct asserted and some specific evidence that supports it in order to get a hearing. And I'm trying to get my mind around what exactly is the misconduct and what exactly is the evidence.
Certainly, Your Honor, I agree with that what Mr. White would need to show in order to justify having a Schwartz hearing is he would need to allege facts that were sufficient, that if they were true, they would justify reaching the verdict, the conclusion that the verdict was the result of misconduct or bias. In this case, there was essentially, I think, four things presented to the district court. They were as part of Mr. White's initial motion and then also reiterated in his post-conviction. And the first had to do with the fact that Mr. White's counsel had contact with counsel for Nokomis Jefferson.
Right, before we get into the evidence that supports it, what exactly is the misconduct that you're asserting?
Well, Your Honor, we're not exactly certain what the misconduct is, other than that the record contains this.
But don't you have to identify misconduct? I mean, in order to, you know, a Schwartz hearing isn't a fishing expedition to theorize about maybe there's some misconduct if we dig around. Don't you have to tell the district court, here is the misconduct that the evidence is going to prove if we have a chance to go into a Schwartz hearing? So we need to have the hearing in order to establish X. What is the X? What is the misconduct?
Well, I think the X here comes from the second thing that was pointed out to the district court was that Mr. White's counsel had another client tell him that a juror told him that she was troubled by how the case ended, and then there was the way that this...
No, I mean, I get the evidence. I do want you to talk about that, but I'm just trying to understand what is the misconduct?
Well, we don't know exactly what the misconduct was or what resulted in a jury verdict.
Well, what misconduct did your client assert to the district court in order to support the need for a Schwartz hearing?
The conduct that my client asserted was these three or four pieces of evidence that were brought to the district court's attention. And our contention is that when those are taken together, they support a conclusion that something happened that was either misconduct or bias at the end of
that jury.
What was
the misconduct that you think these things would inferentially lead?
Inferentially, we think that they would lead to the fact that the jury resolved the case just so that they could go home and not have to come back in a snowstorm instead of on the merits, where we had a situation where on three of the verdicts they're unable to reach anything resembling a unanimous verdict, and then as soon as they find out, well, we can't sequester you, we don't have transportation.
So that's misconduct? You think that would be, if the evidence showed that the jurors were considering, among all the other factors, their desire to reach a conclusion. We want to get this over with. We don't want to come back tomorrow. Let's get this over. That's misconduct?
If the jury did that instead of deciding the case on the merits, it's our position that that would be misconduct.
And what's the evidence that suggests it was decided not on the merits? What is the, I read the transcript of what was argued to the district court, what was presented to the district court at the hearing. I didn't see anything that smelled of that concern that you're raising, that it wasn't really decided on the merits.
Well, I think it's two things. One is sort of the way it happened, where the jury has got these three counts that it can't reach a unanimous verdict on. They go long into the night with that.
Wait a second. How do we know there's three? I mean, that you're drawing an inference from the question that I'm not sure is supported.
Well, I think that at one point in the record they discussed that they couldn't. I believe the jury sent a note that said that they didn't have a verdict on counts 3, 5, and 6.
I think that I'm not sure that's one way to interpret it. Another way to interpret it is that there wasn't an agreement as to count 3, and then the other two counts are written on, but there's no indication that. And the jury did reach a determination ultimately about count 3.
Yeah, they did reach a determination on everything but count 6, I believe. And so our position is that these things taken together, we have two different counsel for both defendants are getting information from either jurors or family of jurors or people.
Well, that's the other problem I had is the evidence. I think as it was presented to the district court, what I saw was Mr. White's attorney was representing that Mr. Jefferson's attorney had said to Mr. White's attorney that an employee of Mr. Jefferson's attorney had communicated that a family member of a juror had communicated that a juror had communicated that. I mean, at some point, I mean, I don't know how far back and when does a attenuated rumor become non-evidence?
And I understand the point, Your Honor, that that's fairly attenuated, that it's through several different people. But I would also point out that it's in conjunction with what Mr. White's attorney learned from a different client who told him that a juror he worked with told him that she had concerns about how the case had ended. And so,
well, she had concerns about the outcome.
About the outcome.
So you've got one juror, saying, I'm concerned about the outcome, and another juror supposedly relaying through five different people that two of the jurors were holdouts, meaning they weren't convinced at some point before they reached a verdict by the majority. So what, I guess, is my question. So a juror is concerned about the outcome. A jurors, I assume, are always concerned about the outcome. They may be troubled by it because it's a hard thing to reach a verdict of someone's guilt. I'm just not seeing the misconduct. There's other issues for you to talk about, but I was lost on that one. I didn't know what you were arguing. I'm still not sure.
Well, Your Honor, we've presented what was available, and our position is that these things taken in conjunction, where you have the counsel for Jefferson hearing that, and then Mr. White's counsel hearing it directly from somebody who heard it from a juror, would support an inference of misconduct. But I do agree that he does have other claims, and in this case, Mr. White did have a joinder claim that he raised, and he raised it on direct appeal, but I don't think that it was actually decided on direct appeal on the merits of that claim. And ultimately, if you look at the Court of Appeals opinion that decided it, the court wasn't looking at the merits of it, and what they said was, well, Mr. White made sort of a generic argument that he was prejudiced by joinder here, but he didn't support it with any citation to the record, and we're not going to do that for him. But I do think that had appellate counsel pointed the court that first heard Mr. White's direct appeal to the specific parts of the record related to joinder, that there is evidence that shows that Mr. White was prejudiced by joinder. And one way that joinder can make a trial unfair is where the joinder allows in evidence that would otherwise be inadmissible. And this wasn't brought up on direct appeal as far as I could tell, but in this case, the prosecution sought to admit expert testimony related to the New Breed gang.
Why did that matter as to your client, given the way that that case, way it turned out? One, as a matter of prejudice, how the jury determined that this wasn't a shooting for the benefit of a gang, right, as to your client?
I think that the district court actually dismissed those counts.
Right, so how was your client prejudiced by it if the district court dismissed the count?
Certainly, I think the reason my client was prejudiced in this case is because I think the testimony related to gangs, particularly in a situation like this where you have several African-American defendants and they're in a smaller community, is that this testimony about gangs is inherently prejudicial on its own, and it puts sort of the jury, I think it scares the jury is what I think.
But the district court granted defense counsel's motion to dismiss all of the gang-related claims. So that defense counsel is actually successful on that, and that means that the jury can no longer consider any of the evidence related to gangs. I mean, that seems like a pretty big win for defense counsel.
I agree that they did dismiss the benefit of a gang counts, but it doesn't change the fact that the jury heard the testimony about the gangs in this case, in particular about the New Breed gang, and had Mr. White not been tried with Jefferson, I do not believe that that would have been admissible, and it's not something that the jury would ever have even heard about and been able to even consider at all in any way, because I don't think there
but
was
they
any...
It wasn't just dismissed, but the jury wasn't allowed to hear evidence that Mr. White was affiliated with that gang.
I don't think that the expert was allowed to testify that either person was in a gang, but they were still able to present some testimony about gangs in this case. And I do think that that is at least a little bit on its own prejudicial to my client because he wasn't a gang member.
So how, if there is no evidence tying your client to membership in the gang, then how was your client, given the high burden that has to be shown for ineffective assistance of counsel, how does that meet the second prong of Strickland?
Well, I think it meets as far as an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim, which we raised this through, if we're able to show that Mr. White had, if this issue was raised on direct appeal and would have been successful, then we believe that it satisfies the prejudice prong.
Right, but it only would have been successful if it was prejudice in the, not to raise it in the district court. If it was prejudicial to your client in the district court, if the outcome would have been different, or likely would have been different in the trial. And I'm trying to get a sense of how the this reference to membership in a gang and your client, there's no evidence in the case that the jury heard that your client was a member of a gang. How do you reach that part of Strickland? How can you show prejudice?
Well, the way we can show prejudice is essentially we've identified in this brief three areas that Mr. White was prejudiced by joinder. The first that we argued, or that I've argued here, was that he was prejudiced because of joinder allowing in the testimony about a gang. And I agree that the charges related to crime for a benefit of a gang were dismissed, but also that the jury was able to hear and did hear this gang testimony, even though it wouldn't have been applicable to Mr. White, and it's not something that would have been part of the trial, and I think that's prejudicial to him.
How?
It's prejudicial because I think that the gang testimony itself is somewhat inherently prejudicial because of the nature of injecting that this was some kind of gang crime into this offense when ultimately the district court concluded after hearing all the evidence that it wasn't a gang crime. And so I think that even putting that in front of the jury is one part of what prejudiced Mr. White in this case. The second way that he was prejudiced in this case is because of antagonistic and inconsistent defenses. And what the panel of this court concluded in looking at Mr. White's claim on direct appeal was that Mr. White had generally argued that but had not pointed the court to the places in the record that would support a conclusion that there had been antagonistic defenses. But I do think that those are also present in the record in this case. And it started even before trial when there was argument on joinder where counsel for Jefferson pointed out that she said, being we are essentially pointing the finger at Mr. White, the defenses in this case become antagonistic. She went on during that argument to point out that Laster had said that Mr. White was the shooter in this case and that she intended to tell the jury that's what's true. And then when trial started, they also made the same arguments where Jefferson pointed directly to White, and it happened throughout trial in this case. And so I do think there was evidence, and we pointed it out in our brief, that is there and does show that he was prejudiced. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, and you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal as well. Counsel for respondent, you have 15 minutes. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing before you begin.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, my name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general and I represent the respondent, state of Minnesota. I'm just gonna apologize right up front. This month, my respiratory system, I've got a scratchy throat, I'm coughing a lot, so if you have trouble understanding me, I apologize, but I've been struggling with the smoke in the air. The issue before this court is whether the post-conviction court abused its discretion when it dismiss the petition without holding an evidentiary hearing. Based on the appeal, the prior appeal to this court, and based on the record in front of it, the post-conviction court did not abuse its discretion.
I have a problem with that. I'll tell you the trouble I have with it is this court carefully analyzed the issues that were raised in the prior appeal and rejected, for lack of citation to the record, the allegation on appeal that there was misjoinder based upon finger-pointing defenses. This court said that appellant asserts in his brief that Jefferson's counsel repeatedly pointed the finger at appellant during trial, but he does not back up that assertion with citations to the record. And here in appeal in this case, we have citations to the record of what I think would, at least arguably, is finger-pointing. Was it competent for defense counsel to raise an argument in the prior appeal without citing record to support the conclusory assertion about finger-pointing?
Counsel for appellant in the direct appeal, very experienced attorney. The only thing that can be pointed to is statements that were made in the opening in defense counsel for Nokomis Jefferson in their opening. Their closing, however, and I'm looking on star three of the White decision, NJ's theory of the case was that the state failed to prove that he was the shooter. An appellant did not claim that NJ was the shooter or try to place the blame squarely on NJ. And that was the argument that Nokomis Jefferson's attorney made in their closing is, it doesn't matter who the shooter was. The only evidence that the state has presented that my client was an accessory or an accomplice is that he was there, and presence alone is not enough.
Well, there were citations to the record of arguments made to the court and then to the jury, at least just in opening. Was it competent for counsel not to point that out to us on appeal while making a claim about finger pointing, not referencing anything in the record to support the claim?
Well, I don't think it's finger pointing. In that opening statement, the Nokomis Jefferson's attorney just laid out what they expected the state's evidence would be. Jefferson never took the stand, and in appellant's reply brief on page 3, it cites that Jefferson and his counsel did directly attack White as the shooter. That's not true. Jefferson never took the stand. He did not himself point to White as being the shooter. But so, well, regardless.
But the argument was made that there was finger pointing. So either, well, so you're, I guess you're saying then that there was no merit to the argument to this court, as opposed to it being incompetent for making the argument without telling us a basis for it in the record.
I don't think the appellate counsel erred, even if there was an error, though. Was there prejudice? Again, this is an opening statement, not an opening argument.
Right, but it's a different question about whether there was prejudice, and I think that's something we've got to analyze. But
whether there was competence is my question.
Presenting an argument to this court without citing to the record. So you're saying, well, but the argument was a failure to begin with. Assume for a moment that we don't think it was failure. Was it that? Assume that that was at least a competent, reasonable argument. Was it competent not to cite the record, cite us to those parts in the record that appellant's counsel in this case has identified for us?
I don't think it was. It was lack of competence. Again.
I shouldn't be using incompetence. Ineffective assistance, that's probably more fair.
But the first prong of the Strickland, I don't think that fell below an expectation of appellate counsel's performance. This was an opening statement. It's not an argument to the jury. It's just an opening statement where Jefferson's counsel is laying out the evidence that the state has already laid out as part of their opening. We go to the argument, the closing argument. I think that's the nuts and bolts of it here. And there's no mention in the Jefferson's counsel's closing argument pointing to White as the shooter. But regardless, the second part that I quoted from this court's opinion, an appellant did not claim that NJ was the shooter or try to place the blame squarely on NJ. So they did not have antagonistic defenses. White was blaming Vance Laster as the shooter, not blaming Nokomis Jefferson. So even if you assume that there was some antagonism with Jefferson pointing at White, the converse isn't the case.
Why isn't that enough, though? If Jefferson's interests were antagonistic to White, why isn't that enough?
I think if Jefferson had taken the stand and claimed that White was the shooter, I think if Jefferson's counsel would have argued it in closing argument, there would be more heft to the argument. But
that wasn't done. What about cross-examining witnesses in a way that suggested that Mr. White had helped was the one with the gun? Is that enough? If not, why not?
That evidence was going to come in anyway. It came in from the state. The question is,
well, it's a different question. That argument, I think, is, well, whether it was prejudicial, and that's a legitimate argument to make. But my question now just goes to the first prong, or the first part of the question, which is whether the case was being made, either in cross-examination or by argument to the jury, that your client was the shooter.
Whether the appellate counsel's performance was substandard, I think factors in, would appellate counsel have felt that that was evidence that they needed to bring to, in front of this court on direct appeal? So I know it sounds like I'm arguing the prejudice, but actually I'm arguing that appellate counsel, when evaluating this case, could have legitimately believed that that wouldn't have changed the result. So that's the performance, is did the appellate counsel's performance fall below a standard? And if appellate counsel could have concluded that that's not going to help move my, it's not going to get the football across the goal line for me or move it down the field, then that performance was not substandard.
But if he made the argument to the court, that's the circular part of it, I think. It's like, well, you know, it was to say it was reasonable not to explain why he was making the argument or the basis for the argument. It seems troublesome. I mean, if the argument is, well, a competent lawyer would recognize that citing this information wouldn't have helped, well, why make the argument?
I think the counsel did the best they could with the record they had. I'll just leave it at that.
Fair enough.
I think counsel did the best they could. And again, this is experienced appellate counsel. She has handled dozens, if not hundreds, of these cases. She knows how to evaluate a case, and I don't think we're in a position here to second guess how she handled that case under the Strickland prong. And as far as the gang testimony, in the reply brief, in footnote 5, drops down that stating that gang testimony was admissible because Jefferson met the definition of a gang member, and that cites to page 1968 of the transcript. Actually, what the prosecutor said was, and Vance Laster, I believe, meets the definition of a gang member. So there was no evidence of either Jefferson or White being in a gang presented.
And that witness was going to have to testify no matter whether it was joined or not.
Correct. Laster was the key to both cases for the state. And then just going on, once the court allowed that testimony, it goes from line 14 on page 1969 to line 9 on 1970. That's the extent. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 questions from the prosecutor and then answers. As far as prejudice, given that the number of witnesses and the number of the amount of testimony, I don't think counsel can prove that that was prejudicial. If the court has any other questions, I'd be happy to address them. Otherwise, I will rest on my brief.
I don't see any other questions. Thank you very much, counsel.
Great. Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. So I just have a couple of things that I want to point out here. There was questioning during the course of trial where it appeared that counsel for Jefferson is emphasizing things that are beneficial to Jefferson, which are also in turn harmful to White because of the way that they sort of positioned the case, even in the opening statement, saying that there isn't going to be any direct evidence of Jefferson and everything's going to be that White is the person who did this. And you can see that, for example, in the questioning of the witness whose initials are RP, and then looking at in the range of 1428 in the transcript. You also see that with Vance Laster's testimony in the range of 1840 in the transcript. So I do think that there's evidence of that also during the questioning.
Is there any reason to believe that Mr. Laster would have testified differently if the cases were separated? I mean, that was a compelling testimony of your putting the gun in your client's hand.
I agree that Laster is really the only witness who, at least at trial, identified Mr. White as the shooter. But I think that the prosecution would have brought out the testimony they did, but Mr. White would not have also then had his co-defendant sort of reiterating and bringing that further out into the jury. And I do think that there's prejudice there. And really what we're pointing to is, as far as the prejudice from the joinder, I think we should look at all three of the areas that we sort of identified in our brief and conclude whether or not those show prejudice as a whole.
Well, if we take them apart and see that one or two of them show no prejudice at all, then mixing them together doesn't add anything to the prejudice equation.
Well, we disagree that it doesn't show any prejudice at all because of, and you know, I spent quite a bit of time talking about this earlier, but we do think that it's prejudicial that there's more emphasis on the fact that, you know, bringing out this stuff about Laster saying it's White because Jefferson reiterates it because of the gang testimony, because of just sort of a general confusion that we see where Mr. White's counsel says, well, I don't know if I'm going to make an opening statement. I have to hear what Jefferson says, and then I'll decide. And then you see in their opening that counsel is addressing both what Jefferson said and what opposing counsel said. And so I do think that there's prejudice in there. And, you know, I would just close by addressing the fact that I think, as the Judge Ross mentioned, that Vance Laster is really the main person putting Mr. White as the shooter in this case. And so the evidence is not overwhelmingly proving my client's guilt under these circumstances. And I think the court should keep that in mind when determining if and when he's prejudiced by his various claims.
Well, but that's a sufficiency of the evidence argument. I don't think that issue is being raised. But I want to go back to the joinder issue. What isn't the evidence of so-called evidence of Jefferson pointing the finger at White as being the shooter, isn't that really just limited to the arguments by counsel?
Well, I do think that if we look at, for example, the questioning of Laster in the page 1840 range, you see the counsel for Jefferson's bringing that out more. But I do agree that Jefferson especially argued in opening, you know, making direct statements. I think one of them was, this isn't a direct quote, but it's very much along the lines of, White is the person holding the gun, re-emphasizing these things, because essentially Jefferson's defense is, there's no evidence I did it, it's all White. And so every time this comes up where something points to White but not Jefferson, it gets reiterated and brought up further in front of the jury. And I don't think that would have happened had Mr. White been tried
but
separately.
So there's no evidence in the record as to any testimony pointing from Jefferson's defense arguing that White is the shooter then?
Well, they argue, I mean, as far as testimony, Jefferson didn't testify, so he never got on the stand and said that. But where other witnesses brought that out, counsel for Jefferson did emphasize that and make it apparent to the jury.
But that testimony came out already based on the prosecution of White.
I agree that it would have, some of that would have come in, but there wouldn't have been a second.
So it was just cumulative. So really what we have is arguments by counsel. Arguments by counsel are not evidence, and the jury is specifically instructed not to consider arguments by counsel as evidence. And what I'm getting to is, so our prior opinion, when we say there's no citation to the record, is accurate, because there is nothing in the record per se pointing the finger at White as being the shooter then.
Well, I agree that there is no testimony, but I don't agree that counsel for Jefferson didn't frame this case from the very start as in, White did this, right, Jefferson did.
But there's no evidence in the record.
Well, not as far as testimony evidence, no.
So why is appellant's counsel ineffective by failing to point to anything in the record when there's nothing in the record to point to?
Well, I do think that, I mean, it's not direct testimony, but I do think there are factors in the record, especially where the jury is being told these specific things, and it's not testimony, but it is part of the record.
Well, what our court said was, appellant asserts that in his brief that Jefferson's counsel repeatedly pointed the finger at appellant, not that there was evidence. And then our court said that he doesn't back that up with any assertions and any citation to the record, which I'd assume would be the citations you provided with regard to what counsel was arguing.
Correct. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your oral arguments. Very well done, as always. We appreciate that. We will be issuing an order within the 90-day statutory time.